we hear people complaining about homelessness and unsheltered folks, when we hear people complaining about crime, when we hear people on Nextdoor and Facebook complaining about whatever it is folks complaining about, at the root cause is poverty. At the root cause is economic insecurity. At the root cause is this problem that we will always have to contend with. So we have to solve it. Like, it's not going away.
Welcome, you wonderful, purposeful, and beautiful humans to Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins. Hope Still Wins is a place where we get to know thought leaders from diverse backgrounds and differing worldviews to help us feel less alone, more connected, and move us to become a better world together. Each week, I'll be interviewing inspiring and relatable guests in attempts to get to know their hearts, celebrate their stories, and explore the concept of hope to hear how and if it has played a role in their lives, ultimately answering the question, does hope still win? If so, why? And if not, why not? And today, you're in for a treat. Are you ready? I'm sitting down with Michael D. Tubbs, who is the author of the memoir, The Deeper the Roots. He's the special advisor to California Governor Gavin Newsom for economic mobility, founder of End Poverty in California, EPIC. And if those aren't inspiring enough, Michael was the previous mayor of Stockton, California at the age of 26, which made him the youngest mayor of any major American city. The impact Michael has had and made at such a young age is inspiring, to say the least. And he is just getting started. If you're an inspiring leader and looking to be part of the solution to end poverty, I think you're really going to enjoy today's episode. Well, hey, let's just jump into it. In this episode of Hope Still Wins, here is Michael D. Tubbs. Michael, thank you so much for joining Hope Still Wins.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Hey, Michael, we've been following your story for a while. You've been somebody that we've really been excited to get on this podcast. And there's a couple reasons why. One, really to learn about you. Two, to learn from you. And I think today's conversation is going to do both those things. So I want to start by giving you a few minutes here, if you don't mind, to just tell people a little bit about your story. Maybe if they aren't familiar with your work, who you are, and how maybe they would best know you.
Yeah, my name is Michael Tubbs. I'm from Stockton, California. I'm a father of two. I'm married to an amazing woman, Anna. I used to be the mayor of Stockton, California. I was 26 years old when I was elected. And before that, I was on city council. So I spent my entire 20s in local government. I'm Stockton's home. So when it was talking about roads or any issue we talked about was one that was deeply personal or deeply intimate or deeply affected people I knew. Which made the job very challenging, but also very rewarding at the same time.
So you were, at the time, the youngest mayor in the country. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, absolutely. I was the youngest mayor of a city of more than 100,000 people ever when I was elected 5 years ago or 6 years ago.
So let's start there. What made you, at 26 years old, say, I want to run for mayor, not only because I think I can win, but I think I can have an impact that will be beneficial to the people living in this city I call home?
Yeah, well, when I was in college, I interned in the White House when President Obama was president. And my job then was working with mayors and councils. And in doing that, I saw at the local level how people were leading and getting things done. And at the same time, one of my cousins was a victim of a homicide in Stockton. It was really his murder, Donnell James, his murder that caused me to think about going back home. So because of that, I ran for city council, spent 3 years on city council and saw how city government worked, saw what could be done, what couldn't be done, and just thought I could make a bigger impact as mayor, particularly on the issue I cared about, which poverty, violence, opportunity for folks. So that's sort of the short story of why I decided to run for mayor, but it really stemmed from 6 years prior to me running, my cousin being like a victim of a homicide in Stockton.
So I'm very intrigued to learn from you on the issue of poverty. And so if I don't know how familiar you are with the work that we do kind of behind the scenes at Hope Still Wins, and then also with a couple organizations that we work with, but
the coffee company.
Yeah. Thank you, buddy. So Michael, one of the things that we wanted to do with Generous Coffee was to invest in nonprofits and social causes that were fighting human facing injustice, with poverty being the one that had affected the founders of Generous and myself included the most. And, I want to ask a fairly ignorant question, I think it is, because we invest into organizations that are going out and doing the work. We are like the really behind-the-scenes team that just tries to raise the funds. When you are looking at your city of Stockton, and you're saying poverty is such a pressing issue in this city, and it's something that's so much on your agenda and desire and passion, how do you even start? How do you not get overwhelmed? Maybe this is even a bigger question. How do you not get overwhelmed with a problem such as poverty to where it paralyzes you? Instead, you say, no, I can start making a difference.
Yeah, no, I think to the point of your question, it's entirely overwhelming when you think of like the poverty. But for me, it's just spending a lot of time studying the issue and realizing it's overwhelming, but not because it's an unsolvable. Or not because there's not things you can do to actually make an impact. And sort of that has always been my North Star. Like even if something's impossible or looks impossible, I think Nelson Mandela has a quote that says it's always impossible until it's done, which speaks to sort of these big intractable challenges seem overwhelming, and they are, and they'll remain that way unless you start to do something. And I also think just being in proximity to folks living in poverty and growing up in poverty, the idea of not doing something can't cross my mind, particularly on that issue. It's like, no, people are waking up every day and they're thinking like tomorrow could be better and they're working hard and they're thinking about opportunities for their kids. And it's folks like that that I think give me the courage to dream and to think and to push and to imagine what better could be, because folks are doing that literally every single day and they don't have the luxury of being overwhelmed or the luxury to be frustrated by the problem because they're living in it and still have to survive.
What did you learn then personally by growing up in it and around it and then working within it as the mayor of the city? What did you learn from the people that you're serving?
The biggest thing I learned, well, a couple of big lessons. I think number one is that sort of, this is very simple, but I don't think people get this. Like the amount of zeros in someone's bank account isn't necessarily a reflection on their intelligence or how hard they work. Sometimes it is, but oftentimes it's actually not. That there's brilliant people who are poor. There's brilliant people who are living in poverty. There are brilliant people who are hardworking who just don't have enough money. And there's not so brilliant people who are lazy, who have a lot of money. Like, and I think that was a big learning. It's that, no, like someone's bitten wealth or income isn't actually a good proxy for their intelligence or effort. And then number two, as a mayor, and that's what we did the basic income program in Stockton, where we gave families $500 a month. It was really an exercise in trust, and that I can trust my constituents. I can trust my constituents, even those with less money than me, to make the right decision for themselves and their families without to spend money. And then number three, I really think in this country, we have to reckon with the fact that there's almost a unanimous contempt for folks who don't have money. That and it expresses itself in different ways, but even folks who are quote unquote progressive or quote unquote liberal, there's a latent mistrust of poor people. There's this idea that they must have done something to be poor. Or they must lack something other than money, which is why they're poor. And I really learned that that's not the issue. The issue is that we've created entire industries with poverty wages. The issue is that we have a history of this in this country of exclusion and marginalization. So those are some of the things I learned about poverty while being mayor.
So, I mean, and it kind of goes along with this then, what do you think the current narrative about people living in poverty and poverty in general is? Maybe, you know, because yes, you were the mayor of Stockton. Now you're on to other work. And so in general, now that you've, you know, lived in your city, worked in your city, now you're, you know, working outside of your city. What are you learning about the current narrative of poverty around, especially California?
I'm obsessed with narrative and storytelling, particularly as it pertains to poverty, because as you mentioned, when I was mayor, when we were doing these things, the thing we were contending against the most was like the tropes people had about poverty. And what I'm seeing, not just in Stockton, but in the state and in the country, is a couple things. Number one, the story that poverty is not solvable. It's a thing. It's always going to be with us. It's just the way it is. Number two, a story of deserving, like who's deserving and who's not. And if you don't have money, it's because you've done something. It's either a divine retribution on your character, or it's a commentary on how hard you work, or it's a commentary on how smart you are. But you did something to be like, that's why you're poor. And I think that makes people not, why should I be, I don't want my tax dollars to those people who don't work. I don't want my tax dollars to those people who don't try or who don't, who aren't contributing. So I think that's a big part of it. And I think that the third narrative, and it's one that is probably the most ubiquitous, is this idea that people should pull themselves out by their bootstraps, that the solution to poverty isn't systemic. It's individual. Like, folks just have to work hard and pull themselves up by their bootstraps and go to school and do well in school, and then everything's fine. If they work hard, they'll achieve success.
Hey, Hope Still Wins listeners. Now I'm taking a quick break from my conversation with Michael to tell you about another incredible show on That Sounds Fun Network. The podcast is called Be the Bridge, with host Latasha Morrison. Latasha was the very first guest on Hope Still Wins because we are huge fans of her and her work. Latasha is a best-selling and award-winning author, bridge builder, reconciler, and a compelling voice in the fight for racial justice. And in 2016, she founded Be the Bridge to equip ambassadors of racial reconciliation. The Be the Bridge podcast is released every other Tuesday, and it's another step in cultivating conversations that will hopefully lead to real change. Latasha and the Be the Bridge team's vision is that people and organizations are aware and responding to the racial brokenness and systematic injustice in our world, and that people are no longer conditioned by a racialized society, but grounded in truth. A couple of noteworthy episodes I think you'll enjoy, some of my favorites. Episode 208, Faith Leaders Raising Their Voice with Beth Moore. Episode 225 with Lecrae. And episode 209, CRT, Critical Race Theory, Why This is a Repeat of History, with Dr. Christina Edmondson and Jamar Tisby. Again, it's the Be the Bridge podcast with host Latasha Morrison. Check it out today, wherever you listen to podcasts. Well, how do we change that narrative then? I mean, and if it's not, if it is systemic, what are some examples of that for our Hope Still Wins audience so they can start to get educated on this and maybe start to look at things a little different?
Yeah, well, in California, we know that housing is so expensive. And we know that the $15 minimum wage is not sufficient to pay for a one-bedroom apartment in 99% of counties in California. Yet, a third to 40% of jobs in California pay minimum wage. So minimum wage by design is a wage that's not enough for you to afford housing, much less transportation, much less childcare, much less medical. Like, that's a poverty trap. We know that in our country, we fund schools based off property taxes. And property taxes are based off how much your home is worth. And if your home is worth more, that means you probably have more money, which means you pay more property tax, which means the schools in your neighborhood have more funding than schools in neighborhoods where there's less value in homes and less property tax. So the schools are less funded and have less resources, and kids go there too. And we also know that housing prices in this country have been set by, or the discrepancy in housing values also has a racial component. We know about redlining. We know that like Lily Banks looked and said, okay, Black people live here. These, let's put a big red around it and make and value these homes less. So now 50 years later, those homes don't have the same equity as other homes. We also know that at the GI Bill wasn't given to everybody. So some folks who served in the Army were giving GI Bill for housing and education, and other folks who did the same service weren't. So, and the list goes on. And I, so I think, Ben, part of the narrative challenge is how do you tell all the things in a way that's not overwhelming? Because that's three things that's like, oh my gosh, it's so much. Like, how do we untangle all this? So I think a big part of it is showing people how all these dots are connected, and also showing people that the same engine, government, that created many of these policies is the same engine that could rectify it, that it's not intractable, that it is, in fact, a choice. And I think the narrative also has to be one of common humanity. This idea that in its basic stuff, like you learn in Sunday school, like we are all God's children. Like we all have equal value. Like we are all equally human. This hierarchy of human value where some lives are more valuable than others or matters more than others is also a big story we have to tell. And then we also know that poverty is also driven, in fact, by the point that women are paid less than men for the same work. And women are more likely to be caregivers than men and aren't compensated for that work. And if a child is raised by a single parent, generally that single parent is a woman who is making less than a man while having more responsibilities in terms of being a breadwinner for a family. Like, and so it's all these isms we talk about really that manifest themselves in the economy, the racism, the sexism, et cetera, manifest itself in what we see as poverty. And then I'll shut up after this, Ben, but why I'm so passionate about this is when I was mayor, and even now, everything people complain about, poverty is a driving factor behind. When we hear people complaining about homelessness and unsheltered folks, when we hear people complaining about crime, when we hear people on Nextdoor and Facebook complaining about whatever it is folks complaining about, at the root cause is poverty. At the root cause is economic insecurity. At the root cause is this problem that we will always have to contend with. So we have to solve it. Like, it's not going away.
Now, you just have walk through a list, right? And it's one of the most pressing reasons why we wanted to do Hope Still Wins. It actually, you know, this is a podcast created to have conversations really across two lines. People of different faith traditions, even though I am a Christian personally, the conversation amongst faith traditions felt contentious. It didn't feel like people were listening to each other. Also, the political divide. You could maybe argue it's getting a little better now where people are maybe more willing to have the conversation. I actually haven't seen that. I've read in articles and I've listened to interviews where people say, no, it feels less contentious now. I'd say I just feel like people might have given up. And so I don't know if that's any better. I don't know if people are talking any more or less. But you just ran through a list of some topics that actually, if you categorize them as on the right or the left, they would have fallen into both. Some would have fallen on both sides. Some would fall in the middle. You've been in the political game now for a few years. How did you see, what was most effective for you in communicating these issues that people would have a hard time arguing that do not exist, right? They are facts. Now, people might have different opinions on if they are warranted or not, but they are facts that have happened. What have you seen be most effective in communicating this to both sides of the political spectrum so that people at least are willing to converse with you or maybe even respond to you with some action?
Yeah, well, when I was mayor, my council was 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats. So everything had to be done in a way that built consensus. And I mean, it was more work. But I think part of it was learning how to communicate in a way that drew by folks from a different party into the conversation versus them feeling immediately like we're adversarial. So I will always talk about, I'm a Christian as well. So I always frame things in terms of values and not, and try to make it not an ideological thing. So when we're doing like basic income in Stockton, the conversation was, well, look, it's an experiment. We don't know what's going to happen. We do know that poverty is an issue, and we do know we have a responsibility to figure something out. So let's test it. Let's rigorously evaluate it. Let's check on it every single month. But don't let what you think might happen stop us from trying. And that really resonated and worked with some of my colleagues on like violence reduction stuff. It was always, I'll always start with the problem. Like, well, we know the problem is the city has a history of violence. We know we have law enforcement officers and they've done, they're there. They've done that. So clearly we need more. Like clearly that's not the solution by itself. So let's try this other solution because the status quo was wrong and we want the city to be safe. And that would work, or even on immigration, because Stockton is a highly immigrant community. And it was always about sort of family values. Like, we want families to stick together. Like, our community is more stable when less people are taken away from their families. Like we want parents and children together. That makes our job as electeds easier. If the parents with the child, our job as electeds are easier because we don't have a kid who's dealing with trauma because their parents been deported. So, I mean, it didn't work every time. That's what I tried to do. And then I also made it a point to build relationship with my colleagues and folks in the community with different political leaning than me outside of when I needed them, so that when I needed them, there's some trust there. So like just, and also being willing to listen and giving people grace to say things that may be offensive or in my opinion, like dumb, but not always jumping down people's throat. It's like, oh, that's interesting. Why do you see it? Like, and also acknowledging when someone has a point. So I know like all my Republican council members would love when they would say something, I would say, I actually did not consider that. That's actually, I see why that makes sense. And they'd be like, what? I'm like, yeah, you're not 100% wrong. We see things differently, but sometimes you say something I didn't consider. And that's like, oh, maybe we should add this. Maybe we should question this way. So I think it's that too, having room for nuance and have room that you're not perfect. You don't know everything. And the folk you're working with is not perfect. They don't know everything. And having room for nuance and saying, you know, I may disagree with 99 of these things, but this one thing you said, I do agree with. So let me just call that out. It says, so it's not just me telling you all the things about how you think I don't like. But it's also like, no, what you said here, I like that. That resonates.
One of the leaders that I really respect and admire, he has a question. And I never know. He does it so much. I don't think he does it only when I say something dumb. But he goes, that's interesting. Tell me more. And in those moments, it gives me the space to then, one, I have to explain myself, right? It's not just an emotional response that I'm able to just sit on and be like, I said that and I mean it. No, I have to actually explain why I believe it. And two, it opens up the door for us to have a conversation. And it's a very simple thing he does all the time is, that's interesting. Tell me more. I mean, I don't know if there is anything as this, but you're a professional listener in a lot of ways. Your nonprofit, Epic, is one of the essential core pieces of that is listening to other people's stories and listening to other people's stories well. Why is that important to you? I mean, you just went through how you navigated the political landscape in Stockton and how you're still doing it today and the work that you're doing today. But you've then taken it off and this nonprofit Epic is something that you're really focused on because you just saw the importance of listening. What was it in that you said, no, this is something that's vital to the future of my life?
Yeah, well, selfishly, I do my best work after I listen. And usually when I mess up, it's because I didn't listen. Right? But like if I sit and I'm able to immerse and listen and build empathy and really understand, it just gives more insight and nuance and color to problems. And I think leads to really innovative solutions. So that's part of it. Number two, particularly because I think this campaign to end poverty is really a narrative campaign as much as it's like a policy one. And through listening, it helps create stories and vignettes and anecdotes that then become sort of the archetypes used to express an idea. So it's not this abstract person in poverty. It's Marissa, a student I met at Compton Community College who has straight A's and sleeps in her car. It's Maurice, an activist I met in South LA who is organizing around violence in the community and doing so while being housing insecure. And I feel like people respond better when you communicate to them with like real human stories. So I think that's part of it. And number three is that oftentimes, and you do this with your podcast and with your work, that oftentimes people in certain predicaments are made caricatures or ideas, but they're never given the chance to say like, well, what do you think? What do you think the solution is? Or why is it like this? Or how should it change? Or how do you want it to change? Like, so I think it's also about empowerment and sort of using my position and limited influence to not pass the mic, but give the mic. Like, no, actually, you didn't go hear from me, you'll hear from them. And then after we hear from them, let's take what we heard and do something with it.
Hope Still Wins community, it's Ben here. And I have something I want to speak with you all about. In fact, Hope Still Wins community, I am calling on you all to help support an organization and a campaign near and dear to my heart. This is the Humanity and Hope United Foundation. And well, as you know, I've been a part of this foundation for 12 years now. But they're running a campaign to help build homes in an isolated community of La Cuchilla. La Cuchilla was affected by two Category 5 hurricanes in late 2020. These hurricanes wiped out their homes. And it also showed that these homes and these communities need to be built to support the storms and the flooding. And well, we want to call on you to help us do that. On May 24th, Humanity and Hope is launching a one-day social media campaign to support the building of homes in La Cuchilla. Homes will be built for each member of the community. And while La Cuchilla is an isolated community in the Sula Valley of Honduras, again, it was affected by being struck by two Category 5 hurricanes in November of 2020. Well, if you want to help, and we would love for you to help, or even just go out to the social media sites for Humanity and Hope United and show your support, you can find all of this by going to humanityandhopeunited.org to donate. And also, there's an informational video there with more information on the campaign. We appreciate your support. We appreciate your help. And thank you for rising to the occasion.
There's an interesting lesson we learned, and we learned this lesson. This is not wisdom from me. This is, I guess, wisdom from life experiences. We do a lot of work in Central America, and the nonprofit that is the main beneficiary of Generous, the coffee company, is called Humanity and Hope United. And we used to go down as a bunch of white dudes from Indiana and tell people in Honduras what they needed. We'd be like, you need a school, you need clean water, and you need health care. And we would do it. We would, you know, build these things and do it. And then they would oftentimes be abandoned, or they just wouldn't be as successful as we wanted. And we one day we stopped and we asked ourselves, like, what are we doing wrong? And through this time we discovered, and we asked them in Honduras, what are we doing wrong? And they said, well, you don't ask us for any of this. And so it changed where now the dynamic, and it's been a beautiful 12-year ride now of a lot of successes. When we go into these communities, we ask them, what do you need? What do you want? What do you dream of? And then how can we help? And those questions lead up to then the how can we help? And they say, well, it would really help us if you would help us fundraise for a new school. We'd say, okay, well, let's go do that. Or, hey, it'd really help us if you helped us find jobs for the women in these communities. And the amount of empowerment and the amount of success that these communities have had based on their own leadership has been incredible when we've gotten out of the way, or when I've gotten out of the way with my own thoughts and allowed them to lead. And so I just wanted to say that to you because it's been a lesson we've learned, and it's a lesson that I think so many people can learn is to start to ask more questions than just give answers.
Yeah, be curious. Just be curious. One of my friends is Evan Spiegel, the founder of Snap.
Yeah.
And someone asked me recently, why is he so successful? I was like, Evan's like incredibly curious. Like he's curious about, like he's always like, why is that? Huh? Like, he's always asking questions about anything. Like he's all, even in college, he was like that. And I realized that, to your point, curiosity is a real superpower. Like not taking things for granted, not just thinking you know, or this is the way it is, but actually like, why? Like, why is it like this? Who did this? What do you think? Can we do it this way? What if we did it that way? It also takes the pressure off you, because if it's up to you to know everything, we're in trouble. I used to tell people all the time, if it's up to me to know everything, we're in big trouble. But if I'm happy to lead and be accountable, but as a community, we often use communal knowledge to get to some of these solutions, because I just don't know everything. I don't know many things, most things actually.
Yeah, it keeps life interesting, and it keeps life fun when you stay curious. And at some point in time, we've determined somebody's intellect or leadership abilities on their ability to make a decision quickly, instead of allowing people the ability to ask a lot of questions and come together. And like you said, I think our best leaders are just ones that hold themselves accountable to staying curious. And I think that's a beautiful thing. Michael, I really enjoyed this week learning about you. I'm going to keep following your story, because I believe you're on to do some incredible things in this world. You already have done some incredible things. I'm just excited that I get to share this life with you. I'm 33, you're 31, I believe now.
Yeah.
I hope we're both around for a long time and I get to watch your story unfold.
We find something to do together. That'd be fun.
I think it would be incredible, man. I really do. And I'm learning from you every step of the way this week. And the issue of poverty is one that does at times feel overwhelming. But like you said, you got to just take the best first step and stay curious. I want to give you the chance here. You do have a book that's brand new. It's out now, called The Deeper the Roots. Can you tell our audience about it?
Yeah, I wrote a book called The Deeper the Roots. It's about sort of how does a 26-year-old with a father in jail become the mayor of a city?
Yeah.
And sort of what is it like to be the mayor at 26 years old? It's about my childhood. It's about my mama, aunt, and grandmother. It's about how to make change. It's about the difficulties of making change. It's about success. It's about failures. It's about love. It's about all the work that still has to be done. So it's called The Deeper the Roots. It's in stores or wherever books are sold. And I actually wrote it. So every word in there, I'm proud of.
It's not an easy task to write a book. I came out with mine in February. It took me about a year and a half. Thank you. It took me a year and a half, and it's one of the hardest things I've ever done. But I'm very glad we did it. So make sure you go check out The Deeper the Roots. I'm assuming wherever books are sold.
Yeah.
Great. Great. Well, we end every conversation with the same question, and I'm really excited to hear your answer. You take it wherever you want to go with it. Whatever comes to mind first is really always the best answer here. Michael, do you believe that hope still wins? If so, why? And if not, why not?
Hope absolutely still wins, but it's not like hope. It has to be hope in action. Like the hope has to fuel something. Like the belief that something's going to be better doesn't make it better, but it's that belief that motivates action that makes it possible. But hope has to win, because it's won before. It has for our future, it needs to win. And it's our job to really actualize that hope. It's not the same as faith, but like faith without works is dead. And I think the same thing is true with hope. Like you show you're hopeful, not with what you say, but what you do. Are you operating in ways that show that, oh yeah, you think this could be better or this could be different?
I never do this. I've done it once before. I have a follow-up question then, if you don't mind. One last question.
No problem.
I'm looking at you. You know, your life hasn't been without some disappointments and some frustrations. You have something in front of you I know you believe in. I've seen it in your interviews. I know the work that you've done. You've done a great job at doing it. You believe in this mission that you're called to and this, you're passionate about it. But like I said, it has had its frustrations. How do you keep going, Michael? Like, how do you now keep, based off the last question, is hope still win? And you said it has to have action, and you've taken the action, and frustrations have gotten in the way. How do you keep going? Why do you keep doing this?
Man, that's a good question. I have two kids now, and they are just brilliant and beautiful and amazing, like all everyone's kids are. And I'm like, they deserve so much better. Like my hope is now not even just for me, but for them to just live in a different world. But before that, I just remember, I think pessimism or nihilism is such a luxury. Cause I remember being like 6 years old and being homeless for a month, or being hungry, or not knowing what the future would hold, not knowing my family had gone to college. So I know, like, and that hope there was so powerful with no evidence. There was no success. There was no book. There was no mayor. And I just really had this belief that it can be better. So now that I'm older, I look back and I'm like, man, if 12-year-old Michael had hope, there's no reason for 31-year-old Michael not. Like, 31-year-old Michael has like a life and opportunity that 12-year-old Michael could barely dream of or conceive that as possible. And it's like, well, so because sometimes I get down, like when I lost re-election, for example, I was like, what? Or when things don't go the way I think they should go politically. But I'm reminded that nihilism and pessimism is such a luxury, and that for a lot of people, hope is literally why they wake up every day, and it's the only reason why they're still going. And me, with sort of the resources and access I have, it's very easy to be hopeful because I'm an embodiment of that hope. I'm like, no, like, you're sad in the reality that was created through hope. So very long and esoteric answer, but that's why I'm hopeful, because if I wasn't hopeful, I wouldn't have been able to do some of the things I've been able to do.
Michael, that's a perfect answer. I mean, I don't know if there's a perfect answer or not a good answer for that. It's your answer, and I appreciate you responding. Michael Tubbs, thank you so much for joining Hope Still Wins. You're one of the best. And again, I am excited to watch your life unfold. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode of Hope Still Wins. And if you haven't already, please subscribe or follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple and Spotify, and join the community over on Instagram at Hope Still Wins. That is it for today, my friends. Reminder to grab a copy of Michael's new book, The Deeper the Roots, and check out his nonprofit, EPIC, which stands for Ending Poverty in California. Thank you again for listening to another episode of Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins, and let's talk next week.